brought to you by me, author Liz Harfel. Country Women's Wisdom is a podcast sharing inspiring true stories, treasured vintage recipes, and useful household hints. It draws on the practical know-how and everyday experience of Australian women, taking on lessons hard won from living through world wars, economic depression, natural disaster, isolation and personal tragedy. They learn how to make a little go a long way while nurturing themselves and their families. In this episode, I share the stories of three mums and a very simple one-bowl orange cake recipe. I'd like to start with a story about Doris Turner. Doris grew up in the New Forest in England, where her parents worked as servants. Her father was a coachman to a big house, and at the time he met her mother, Janetta, she was a housemaid. They lived in the gatehouse of the big property, and that's where Doris was born in 1903. She had an older sister and two younger brothers, although one of them died when he was only five, after contracting polio and then pneumonia. As soon as she turned 14, Doris went into service at the manor house too. She was given responsibility round the clock for looking after a three-year-old girl and a brand new baby. Every morning she'd bathe the infant, dress him and take him downstairs for a brief visit with his mother before returning to the nursery. Doris met her future husband Ted when he was recovering from appendicitis. She was friends with his sister, who took her along to visit him in hospital. They'd attended the same village school, but even though there was only a year's difference between them, neither recalled knowing the other. Their daughter Wendy isn't quite sure, but she thinks they married within 6 months of meeting each other, as soon as her mother turned 21. Doris's parents thought Ted wasn't good enough for her and refused to attend the ceremony, but his family was there and his sister acted as bridesmaid. Ted was a market gardener, and he was able to make sure his family, as it grew, had access to plenty of fresh fruit and vegetables. But life was tough until 1938, when an aunt inherited money and gave some to Ted so he could build a brand new house near the market town of New Milton. The single-story bungalow had red brick walls, a tiled roof, and all the mod cons. There were four bedrooms, a large lounge, sitting room and kitchen with hot water, gas and electricity, and there was even enough money for new furniture for the house and a bicycle for each of the children. By that stage, there were six. The youngest of them was Wendy, who I got to know when I was researching the Australian Blue Ribbon Cookbook. I first met Wendy when I went to interview her daughter, Juliana, who was president of the Kalamunda Show Society in the Perth Hills. It turns out that both women were excellent show cooks with more than a few blue ribbons to their name. And when I sat down and started hearing Wendy's story of her childhood and her remarkable experiences, I decided that I would need to find an excuse to return one day so I could capture more of it for a future book. Indeed, that's what happened when I started working a few years later on a book called City Girl, Country Girl, about the adventures of women from overseas and the city who had found themselves living in the Australian bush. And that's exactly what happened to Doris. After the Second World War, Ted decided that they needed to emigrate to Australia. He'd had the idea in mind for a while, but he was becoming fed up with the war and all the rules and regulations that came with it. It proved to be a kind of tipping point, which sent him off to London and Australia House. He had to overcome quite a few obstacles, but eventually the family with 10 children, yes, that's right, 10 children, by then Doris had given birth to four more, ended up on the Empire Brent in 1949, sailing from Glasgow on the east coast of Scotland to Perth in Western Australia. In the meantime, Ted had spent most of the money that was made from the sale of his house and market garden on buying, sight unseen, a dairy farm near Manjimup in the southwestern corner of the state. To give you an idea why this story fascinated me so much, I thought I might read to you the first page of City Girl, Country Girl that tackles the story of Doris and Wendy. Doris Turner had a reputation for remaining calm in a crisis. Having lived through two world wars and the Great Depression by the time she was in her early 40s, she was usually quick to see the humour in any situation and rarely lost her temper, no matter how much her patience was tried by Ted and their 11 children. Her daughter Wendy cannot recall seeing her cry. The first sight of her new home in the Australian bush broke that resolve, at least for a moment. It was the end of a stinking hot day in March 1949 when the Turner family arrived at the farm they'd purchased sight unseen from the other side of the world. Doris was in the front seat of the truck nursing her 18-month-old baby daughter Mavis. Her husband Ted was on the back with the rest of the children. Hot, tired and bedraggled, they perched on bales of hay as the truck rattled over the last 10 corrugated kilometres of gravel road. The vehicle's wooden tray had been hosed down in an unsuccessful attempt to get rid of the smell of pig manure, but that didn't worry them so much. The Turners were used to farm animals. The heat was another thing, and the flies, and the all-pervading dust that had settled all over their Sunday best clothes, donned so they would look their finest for such a momentous occasion. The Turners had left the immigrant camp at Point Walter in Perth early that morning, excited to be on the final leg of their journey. A slow train took them south to Bunbury, where they climbed onto a bus for the next 130 kilometres to Manjimup. The trip seemed to take forever as the bus rattled over gravel roads, stopping occasionally in the middle of nowhere to drop off bags of mail. There was no cooling system, and everyone sighed with relief when they were allowed to get off in Bridgetown for refreshments. As the bus passed through established orchards near the town, the children spotted apple trees, branches heavy with bright red fruit, waiting to be picked. Closer to Manjimup, farms were still being carved from the bush. To the Turners' English eyes, the landscape was bleached of colour. Turning into the driveway of their new home, they passed ghostly stands of dead eucalypts, ring-barked but not yet cleared, and pasture bled white gold by the sun. There was no sign of life until the ground shifted in a tawny blur as hundreds of startled rabbits ducked for cover. Hardly able to take it all in, 11-year-old Wendy and her siblings looked up the rise to a small weatherboard building just below the brow of the hill. "There's the shed, but where's the house?" one of the girls asked. And then the truth dawned. The new house that Doris found herself living in was a far cry from the beautiful modern bungalow that she'd left behind in the New Forest. Although it had been spruced up a bit for their arrival, there were only four rooms for a family of 11. No electricity, no plumbing, and the toilet was in the backyard, which was all pretty typical for farmhouses in those days. Once the initial shock wore off, Doris decided that what was done, and there was no point in complaining. Wendy says her mum always laughed, always joked, never got sad, and never got cross. She'd get disappointed, but she'd never be cross. And Wendy herself doesn't ever remember seeing her crying. One of the first issues that had to occupy Doris's mind was where everyone was going to sleep, because there were only two small bedrooms. So Ted and Doris took one, with the baby, another was assigned to the girls, and the boys all found themselves sleeping under a tarpaulin on the front veranda, or in an old creamery not far from the house. It was very small, but two of her brothers squeezed in there and tried to ignore a snake that lived nearby. The house had two verandas, one at the front and another at the back, which was partially closed in to create a tiny kitchen. There was just enough space for a small working table alongside a green enamelled Metta's wood stove and a larger dining table in front of a long bench with a kitchen chair at each end. At the other end of the same veranda was another enclosed area about the same size that served as the bathroom. It housed a big tin bath, but there was no plumbing except for a pipe to remove the wastewater. The house had two small rainwater tanks to supply water for drinking and cooking. Water for bathing and washing clothes had to be carried up from the creek in large milk cans borrowed from the dairy and then heated in a copper. In the summer, the creek would start to dry up, so Wendy recalls the water was often full of twigs and leaves and even leeches and the occasional frog which would float past her in the bath. 6 days a week, everyone would make do with a quick wash, standing in a small amount of water. That operation was moved into the lounge room in the winter in front of a big open fire, but bath night proper came round every Saturday. The youngest children would go first, Doris would put a small amount of water in the bottom of the bath and use her best soap to wash the babies. And then the creek water and a splash of Dettol antiseptic liquid would be added in batches as the older children took their turns, making do with harsher Lifebuoy soap to wash their hair. Ted came last, and by then the bath would be pretty much full of muddy water smelling strongly of antiseptic. That wasn't the only challenge they faced. The house on the whole had been pretty seriously undermined by termites. Doris ended up making a series of intricate rugs, woven out of scraps of material, which covered the holes in the floors where the worst damage was done inside the house. And when neighbours would come along, she would encourage them not to stand on the mats. Wendy says the neighbours all thought her mum was very house proud, but in fact she was more concerned they might go through the floor and break a leg. The farm wasn't in a much better state than the house. The cows that had been left with the property were the scrawny runts of the herd that no one had really wanted, and the previous owner had managed to sell the best cows off. But the greatest challenge was getting rid of the rabbits. There were a plague of them in their thousands, and the infestation was so bad that the children caught more than 100 rabbits a day before and after school. Most of them were cooked down in a big copper, skin and all, and fed to the pigs, but a good number ended up on the dinner table because the Turners really couldn't afford to ignore this plentiful food source. They were skinned and taken up to the house, where Doris soaked them overnight in a large bowl filled with water and vinegar. To make up for the monotonous diet, she became extremely inventive in how to cook them. Wendy says she used to roast them, bake them, curry them, you name it. The children were not always impressed. "Not rabbit again, Mum," they'd chorus. "Never mind. It'll put a little hop in your day," Doris loved to reply. At one stage, the Western Australian government provided poison to landholders to help them get on top of the plague. It was meant to be laced through large batches of apples, which they also provided, and then Ted would feed them out through a hopper towed behind a horse and cart. The next day, the children would head out into the paddock and collect the dead rabbits, which were dumped in hollows and then burnt. This approach to rabbit control brought unexpected benefits for Doris because she would hijack some of the apples before they were treated. They were a soft apple called Cleo, which Wendy recalls were very good for cooking, and she can still see her mum with a whole bucketful peeling them and cutting them up into a big saucepan so she could stew them. Wendy's memories of those early years on the farm are dominated by laughter, frequently at the family's own expense as they adapted to a strange new country. She recalls her mother's first lesson in Australian slang. After helping them to settle in, neighbours told Doris they'd be back the next morning with 12 chooks. Now, where Doris came from, there was a very similar word used to describe little pigs, so she told Ted to get a pen ready to hold them. Ted was extremely puzzled that anyone would be so generous as to give them so many pigs, small or not, but he dutifully set to work. The next morning, the neighbour drove up in his truck with some crates on the back, and he took one look at Ted's handiwork and said to him, "Well, that's no good, they'll fly out." Still laughing when she thinks about a country where it seemed that pigs really did fly, Wendy adds with great understatement, "We had a lot to learn." To help them get by, all the children, as they got old enough, were expected to find jobs off the farm to bring in some extra money. In the early 1950s, one of the main options around Manjimup was hoeing and picking tobacco. In an aspect of Australian history largely forgotten now, Western Australia set about establishing a tobacco growing industry because they thought it would make a lucrative cash crop to boost the economy. So the first commercial crops around Manjimup were planted in the 1930s, and by the early 1940s there were more than 600 hectares under cultivation. And there was another growth spurt after the war when immigrants came in from southern Europe where tobacco was an established crop, so they knew how to grow it. Among them were quite a few Macedonian families, and Wendy found herself working for one of them, where she was treated like a daughter. She recalls tiring days of demanding physical labour, fueled by nurturing meals of exotic flavours that she later wove into the meals she prepared for her own family. Her routine started just before dawn when she'd head out into the paddock to hoe weeds, and this would fill her days from October to January, and then picking would start in about mid-January and continue well into March. At 8:30 every morning, she would be brought a hearty breakfast of French toast made with eggs from the family's chickens, olives, roasted capsicums, and hot coffee sweetened with condensed milk. One of her favourite dishes involved grilling and then dressing capsicums with olive oil, garlic, and basil. At lunchtime, the workers traipsed back to the house for a soup so thick it almost qualified as stew. One version was made with lamb and rossoni, tomatoes and big handfuls of fresh mint. And then for afternoon tea, there were sandwiches filled with roast chilies eaten out in the paddock. For a very special treat in the evenings, there might be steak, served with eggs broken into the juices and scrambled roughly. It may have looked horrible, but Wendy remembers the flavour as being remarkable. The Macedonian family took such a shine to Wendy that after a season or two they offered to rent her a hectare of land so she could grow her own crop and keep the proceeds. Farmers weren't required to hold a license to grow tobacco, but they could only purchase seed from the state agricultural department, and the crop could only be sold at the official tobacco auctions held in the city every year. So at the age of 17, Wendy found herself on the front page of the state's rural weekly newspaper because apparently she was the only woman in Western Australia growing tobacco in her own right. The paper described her as a tall, raven-haired English girl with a cultured voice and a flair for hard work. Not only was she good-looking with lustrous hair and a flashing smile, but she could ride a horse, drive a truck, and swing a dexterous hoe. At around this time, Wendy's life changed when she met her future husband, Joe Bonini, a migrant from Italy, who came out after the war looking to make a new future for himself. Disastrously, many of the young men that Joe came out with ended up working at the notorious Wittenoon asbestos mines, which have since claimed so many lives. But Joe ended up heading south and working in a timber mill in a tiny township that was only a few years old. At weekends, he liked to go dancing, and there were dances held quite regularly in little timber halls built in the district. Wendy first set eyes on him at one of these dances, and she found it hard to look away. Always an impeccable dresser, he was very handsome, and he knew how to move, and he was always sharply turned out in a well-cut suit and a pair of blue suede shoes. In fact, Wendy is amazed at the impression she made on him because when they first danced together, she wasn't all that good at dancing, and she says she ended up stepping all over those blue suede shoes, which always reminded her of the famous Elvis Presley song. Of course, Wendy and Joe eventually married, and they raised a family, and in their older years moved to the Perth area. Their daughter Juliana maintained a connection to the land when she married a Perth Hills orchardist, Gary, then raised a family of her own. And in recent weeks, Wendy has become a great grandmother for the first time. So another generation of women are weaving their threads of their story into the stories of Western Australia. As I mentioned earlier, I got to know more about Wendy and her mother Doris when I spent some time with Wendy researching material for City Girl, Country Girl, a book I wrote about women from overseas and the city who ended up in the bush. And that book was inspired by my own mother, Elaine. My mum was born in 1925 in Bendigo, where her father was a butcher. She was only a few years old when the family moved to Frankston on the southern side of Melbourne, where her father continued working as a butcher, and Mum recalls that there always seemed to be plenty of food on the table even during the worst years of the Great Depression, and occasionally there was money for some special treats. She particularly remembered going to the local corner shop on a hot summer night to get peaches and then coming home and having them with ice cream. One of her strongest memories of her childhood may resonate with us today as we are all battling with the impact of coronavirus. She was going to primary school in grade 4 when she caught diphtheria from a boy who sat next to her in the class. This was a very contagious disease and it was rife in parts of Melbourne at the time, and whole schools were shut down to try and help stem the spread. Mum became delirious one night with a soaring temperature, and the family doctor recognised the symptoms and sent immediately for an ambulance, which took her to the Fairfield Infectious Diseases Hospital. Within days, she was joined by her mum and her younger sister Ray and her youngest brother John, who'd all caught it despite her mother's attempt to disinfect the house by sealing cracks around the doors with newspaper and burning sulphur, which was the recommended approach in those days. The rest of the family recovered within a few weeks, but my mum didn't. She ended up being in Fairfield for 3 months and 2 days. She remembers precisely how long it was, and that in itself is very telling. Her experiences through the illness were amongst the most distressing of her long life. Mum was put upstairs in Ward 2, and from there she could see another ward downstairs, which was full of even sicker children. And she recalls quite clearly at night looking down from the balcony of her room to where their beds were and seeing them wheeling the little kids that had died out into the morgue, often two or three a night, covered over in sheets. She'd never been away from home before and she missed her family terribly. And once Vida was discharged, she was only permitted to make one visit and they were not allowed to hug or touch. Mum was kept behind a wire cage with her mother standing no closer than a few metres. At the time when I wrote the story, I described these as draconian measures, but we all know that when it comes to a seriously infectious disease, they're very necessary. And it's clear the hospital was doing its best and applying best practices of the day to help the patients get better, but it was a very traumatic experience for my mum. If a child at the hospital was discovered to have lice or fleas, everyone in the ward was completely submerged in a fennel bath. And if a child wet the bed, one of the night shift nurses thought the best deterrent was to smack them hard on the bottom. My mum had kidney problems before the diphtheria, and she was unfortunate enough to have this happen more than once. The diet they were forced to eat was pretty terrible too. Mum says that it came on a trolley, and it was usually a gluey mass by the time they got it. They had tripe for lunch every day, and rice or sago for dessert. And then there was tea with milk and bread at 3 o'clock, and then nothing else before they went to sleep. The doctor would come and swab their noses and throat every day to check if patients were clear of infection, and they'd be given two pieces of fruit after that, which for Mum was a highlight. Mum wasn't given a clean bill of health until the doctors removed her tonsils, and then finally the swabs cleared, and she could go home to her family and get that much longed for hug from her mother. After she finished school and she went for the final years to a girls' school in Bendigo, she returned to Melbourne and got a job as a bookkeeper for a chain of menswear businesses called Fred Hesse Proprietary Limited. Mum worked in the main office in Elizabeth Street under the steely eye of a woman called Miss Jenkins, who later also employed Mum's sister, Aunty Ray. She was a formidable woman who kept a close eye on the staff. But she recognised my mum's skill. She was given an adding machine and she had to account for every single penny. She loved the work and she loved the social life that went with it. It was the war years and there was plenty of entertainment in Melbourne to keep the American and Australian troops amused while they were visiting on leave or for training. So she went dancing at least 3 nights a week with employees from Fred Hesse's, including on Monday nights when they would go to the Earl's Court Ballroom in St Kilda, and then afterwards they'd have supper somewhere together in Ackland Street, which is a very well-known strip of little restaurants now. There would be more dancing on Friday nights and then on Saturday nights too. Mum was a very good dancer and she was never short of partners. She even learnt the latest American craze of the jitterbug with its twists and spins and tosses and fascinated us as children, describing how she would fly through the air and roll over her partner's head. Mum met my father, Lyle, during the Second World War when my dad was in the Air Force. He was sent to Melbourne as part of his training to be an aircraft engineer. And the night after he found out that he'd successfully passed his exams, he and a couple of mates headed to Luna Park, the amusement park at St Kilda, which was a very popular place to go during the Second World War. It just so happened that on that same night, my mum was there with her sister Ray and some girlfriends, and as Mum tells it, her best friend Mari started flirting with the group of servicemen, and my mum, seeing the direction that things were headed in, decided that she would latch onto one quiet young man who seemed to be more sober than the rest of his mates, and that turned out to be my dad. The next day they went on their very first date, which was going to see the Puffing Billy steam train in the Dandenong Ranges. And Dad told the story that, seeing them together, one of his mates said, "You know what, you're going to marry that girl one day." And of course, he did. After the war had ended, he married Mum and took her back to the little farming district of Mallel near Mount Gambier, where, much like Wendy's mum, Doris, she found herself in a very simple farmhouse with no plumbing at all, not even a cold water tap, and no electricity, and of course the toilet in the backyard. There was a very old stove, which didn't work too well, and, you know, things did improve. Within a week, a cold tap was plumbed in, so at least she had access to some running water. But power wasn't put onto the house until she'd already started raising a family and had young children to look after. She would talk about sitting by kerosene lamp at night to stitch babies' clothes. One of the biggest improvements that came into the house that my older brother Roger recalls was when they acquired a kerosene-powered refrigerator. And my brother remembers it clearly because Mum celebrated by making ice cream, which is a very rare treat. I decided to write about Mum's story not because it was unique or especially remarkable, but because, in fact, it reflected the lives of thousands of Australian women who met farm boys during the war and then returned with them to the farming districts, where they had to learn how to live a very different life while they were raising a family and becoming part of their communities. So for me, my mum's story was a typical story that reflected the experiences of many women. And for that reason, I think it's well and truly worth celebrating. I found it very difficult to write it, though, and the book was delayed for a year or more because I was partway through working on it and writing Mum's story when she died quite suddenly, not far off her 90th birthday. My final story and the recipe for this episode takes us to the small Riverina community of Walbundry. I visited this little town in 2013 when I was researching stories for the Australian Blue Ribbon Cookbook. And I was taken there because it has one of the best shows in the region and it draws patrons from as far as Wagga Wagga and Wodonga, and horse competitors even come from Melbourne and Sydney. In fact, 7,000 people showed up at the centenary event in 2011, which isn't too bad when you consider the town has an official population of about 40. So while many other shows in Australia started out as ploughing and farm machinery competitions, at Walbundry the event had its roots in a horse race. In 1910, two local horse owners pitted their steeds against each other over a distance of 2 kilometres. They were so taken with the experience they called a community meeting to talk about organising an annual horse parade. And the show grew out of that first parade, which was held in 1911. The other reason I was drawn to the Walbundry show was the story of Shirley Shilg and her two daughters, Tammy and Kimberly. And it's a great story to reflect on for Mother's Day. Shirley was only 44 when she died of ovarian cancer. And it touched the entire community very deeply. So when her daughters announced their intentions to join a major fundraising effort for cancer research, the town got right behind them. So they decided to put the baking skills they'd learnt from their mother to good use and hold a special ladies' lunch at the local hall. They wondered if they'd ever be able to sell the 120 tickets that they had printed up, but within days they were turning people away. The lunch raised an extraordinary $8,000, a significant contribution towards the eventual tally of more than $30,000 that Shirl's girls, as they called themselves, managed to raise with help from their cousins, Jane and Amy. They raised a lot of this money by participating in the inaugural Ride to Conquer Cancer, which was held in October 2012 to support the Peter McCallum Cancer Centre in Melbourne. The idea was that every rider had to raise a minimum of $2,500, which Tammy says she thought was a lot of money when they first got started. Overwhelmed by the response, Tammy saw it very much as a tribute to her mother. Shirley baked for community organisations and was part of a volunteer support group for women with breast cancer. She'd had a mastectomy at the age of 23, when Tammy and her other sister Renee were quite small. Shirley was given the all clear and went on to have two more children, Kimberly and Benjamin. Then at the age of 41, exploratory surgery discovered a cancerous mass in another part of her body. The disease seemed to respond to treatment for a few weeks at a time, but it kept returning. 2.5 years later, Shirley died. While Tammy was more than keen to ride in memory of her mother, there were a few challenges. For a start, she wasn't particularly good at riding a bicycle, and she would have to complete 200 kilometres in 2 days. She told me that as a child she used to ride her bike about a kilometre to the top gate and then back again to catch the school bus, and she'd always fall off. Then there was the show. The ride was the same month as the event, and Tammy was one of its most successful cookery competitors. She loves the show, and she didn't want to give up the opportunity to cook for it. She began entering at the age of 10, claiming her first prize for pikelets. And as an adult, she won Most Successful Exhibitor in the Open section 7 times up to 2012, and on occasions claimed the same trophy at other shows held at Wodonga and Albury and Lockhart. These days, Tammy lives on a sheep and cropping property about 60 kilometres north of her hometown, and she still competes every year, or at least she was when I last spoke with her. One of the recipes she uses that regularly wins prizes is her mum's orange cake, and I'm going to explain how to make this very simple one bowl cake to you today. I've chosen it because of the beautiful story that goes with it, but also because I'm fortunate enough to have an orange tree in my garden, and it is covered with fruit at the moment, and I need to find ways to use it. So this is one of my favourite fallback recipes. First, the ingredients. You need 1 cup of white sugar, 1/2 cup of milk, 125 grams of softened butter, 1.5 cups of self-raising flour, 2 eggs, a pinch of salt, 1/2 teaspoon of vanilla essence, and the grated zest of 1 orange. And because I love the orange flavour, I'm very generous with the amount of grated zest I use in this recipe. So, it's very simple to make. Preheat your oven to 180 degrees Celsius. Now remember, that's for a conventional oven, so if you have fan forced, modify it to the equivalent in your oven. Grease and flour a loaf pan, ideally one that's about 22 by 15 centimetres. And then all you do is place all of those ingredients in a large mixing bowl. All together, no need to cream the butter and the sugar first, just put them all into a large mixing bowl. Use an electric mixer and beat them for a minute on low speed until the ingredients are combined a little, and then turn it up to medium and beat it for another few minutes until the sugar's dissolved and the mixture is smooth and light and fluffy. Now, Tammy doesn't use caster sugar, she uses white sugar, but she says it's really important that you do beat it until the sugar is dissolved, because if you don't, the top of the cake might be a little sticky. So once the mixture is ready, you pour that into the prepared pan and you bake it for about 40 minutes, or until it's golden and firm to the touch. This is one of those recipes, if you're a show cook, you'd be hesitant about putting large skewers through the middle to check that it's done, and I use a technique that was taught to me by a very experienced Queensland show judge, another Shirley, who says cakes like this talk to you, they yabber away. And by that she means when you take them out of the oven, if you put your ear to the cake and you can still hear a sort of sizzling, whispering sound a few seconds after the cake's been out of the oven, then it means it's not done yet. It's still cooking, so pop it back. So once the cake has cooled a little, turn it out onto a wire rack and cover it with a clean tea towel to cool. And when it's cool, this is the icing that you can put on the top. And again, it's a very simple mixture that adds to the orange flavour of this cake. So you'll need 15 grams of butter, the juice of 1/2 orange, and about 1.5 cups of icing sugar. And just mix that together and then put it onto the top of the cake. Now, show cooks usually just use this very neatly on the top of the cake in a thin layer with no decorative drizzles down the side. But if you're making this for your mum for Mother's Day or any other occasion, you can decorate it how you see fit. Thank you for listening to this episode of Country Women's Wisdom. For more information about the podcast and my books, and for a copy of any of the recipes featured, please visit my website, lizharfel.com, or you can follow me on Instagram and Facebook.